The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Thank you for attention. I'm just going to go into the lecture part. I was hoping to actually start with the pitches, but since so many people are missing, we'll wait and do the pitches after the lecture part of our class. And then we'll end class with a chance for you to play games based on the lecture. So it's going to be kind of a weird, like, lecture, talk about your game, play games related to the lecture, and then time for you to talk in your teams about your game again, you know, to continue working on your projects. We'll bring in the prototyping kits for that last bit, so you can start building stuff up. All right, so today's reading was Partlet. Where's my copy of Partlet? Hey folks, so today's reading was, I think, chapter 11 and 12, was that right? Space Control and Fox and Geese games. Corner Your Fauna games, yeah. And the reason why I wanted you to take a look at these, because it's got two sort of historical investigations. Well, it's got a whole bunch of historical investigations of a bunch of different games, but it kind of goes in depth into two particular games, one in each chapter. So, people remember which games were covered in the reading?
No.
No. Really close to that, but you're one letter off.
Go?
Yes, go. And the other one was
Chase game
called
Tuffle.
Yeah. The second chapter that I had you read today starts with like Fox and Geese and a bunch of things, but then it really goes in depth into Tuffle. And this is probably the most in-depth sort of historical research that you find in this entire book. Most of this book is like the stuff in between Go and Tuffle, where it's like, you know, four paragraphs at most on any particular game, and then just talking about variants, right? He talks about Reversi, which is, what, 200 years old? Something like that? I can't remember the exact number. But he only gives, like, maybe, like, two or three paragraphs on his history, and then everything else is just, this is how the game is played. These are the mechanics. And so that if you wanted to figure out how this game, all the things that can come out from the game, you could recreate it just based on the illustrations and the mechanics. But when it comes to Go and when it comes to Tuffle, it's a little bit more about the culture surrounding these particular games. And that's a very different take and an interesting take. So if you're interested in doing sort of academic research in games, that's one way. That's kind of like game archaeology, game historian work. One of our grad students, who's now doing his PhD, Jason Biggie, is kind of doing that for train games and the sort of evolution of train games, even though, you know, obviously those couldn't have been invented before trains existed, so they're not that old, but there are tons of them, and it's just, and he's again tracking this, the evolution, but also the culture, the people who play these games. So, let's see, how many of you played Go? Okay, about five people. How many of you have played a version of Tuffle? And after H-N-E Tuffle, I have no idea how to pronounce it. You played it?
Yeah.
On paper or on iPad? Or
well, I
played the iPad
version. I have a board that I got when I was
high school. Oh, cool. Okay. You can actually find like craftsmen making these things, Tuffle boards. Even though the rules, as if you read the book, the rules aren't really well understood. There's no canonical explanation of here are the pieces and here are the rule and here's what you do with them. You can either find a little bit of one or you find a little bit of the other. So there are some archaeological evidence for here are the different pieces for a full set of Tuffle, and then they don't tell you what to do with it. And then there's another set of it's like this is what you do with all the pieces, but then it seems to be describing a different set of pieces. or a different number of pieces, and you're not quite sure. But you get a lot of stuff like poetic records of the significance of the pieces, and that gives you a clue about what people thought of these pieces, and gives you a clue of what these pieces can do in the game. You know, there are some descriptions of particular plays of this game, which gives you an idea of how these pieces can be made. But, you know, it's viewed within the sort of larger context of, here's an asymmetric board game that's, you know, that is largely involving one group of pieces trying to capture either all or a particular group of another of the other players. That's basically the whole genre of the chase game, of the fox and geese type game. And, you know, viewed from that context of, here are all these other games that have survived a little bit better, like the English Fox and Geese. This is what we can intuit. It's kind of a siege game where both sides have soldiers, but one of them is explicitly trying to kill a king. One side doesn't have a king, and is trying to kill the king, and then the other side has a king, and a bunch of bodyguards, and they're trying to defend the king. And the whole idea is, sometimes it's to get the king to an escape route. Sometimes it's just survive a certain number of moves, or to get to a particular point on the board. That one thing that I would like you to think about, if you haven't read it, do read through these two chapters, just to get a slightly better idea of what you can do with space. That's one thing that we've been noticing, that in some of the games that have been prototyped in this class, space isn't always used very 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 creatively. We see games that have been played out on grids. We've been seeing games where you can move freely throughout the whole grid, but then what does each individual square actually mean in relation to other pieces on the same board is something that these games actually do really well. Both the games of territorial capture, which Go was all about, and the chase games, which are these asymmetric games where you try to surround your opponent. Go and Tafel are not the only two games that are described in here. There's a huge amount of variation and thought about what you can particularly do when it comes to manipulating space, being surrounded. You know, what does it mean to have two of your opposing pieces on either side of you, or an L shape of you? What does it mean to be on a square grid, especially when a game like in Go, it's a game that's played on, you know, squares, on the corners of squares in particular. And it's very, very important that what's to the top and what's to the bottom and what's to the left and what's to the right of every piece is really, really important. But what's to the diagonals isn't really so important until you sort of consider meta strategy, right? What's the effect of a clump of pieces rather than a single piece? The other thing about the section on Go in particular is that you get this huge amount of vocabulary. Words like liberties, the way how scores are being added up, you know, there's words from different languages, so Korean and Chinese and Japanese. But most of the research in this particular book refers specifically to the Japanese tradition, so most of the terms are used in Japanese. How many of you heard of Atari? Come on. Yes, Atari.
Oh,
Right, you've heard it. That's actually supposed to be a derivation of Watari, which is a Go term. Don't ask me what the term means. I don't actually play Go, but it's, you know, these words have kind of like worked its way into even cultures that don't play Go that much, like in much of the Western world. In the same way that Alia has made its way into talking about games and chance, because that means dice in Latin, die specifically in Latin. in the same way that, you know, sometimes we talk about being checkmated, even when you're not playing a chess game. You know, I'm trying to think of other chess terminology that tends to make its way into common English parlance. Huh?
Sugswain?
What?
Sugswain?
Sugswain?
Yeah, the least best move.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The least worst move. Yeah. That's a neat term. I'm not sure if that's specifically from chess. I'm thinking more about
Well, it's used in chess much.
It's a concept that applies to chess in particular a lot. But
like tempo.
Yeah.
It's probably a term that derives elsewhere that's applied in chess. But do you think about tempo in games?
Well, I think about tempo in games. I don't really think about it in chess so much because I don't play that much chess. but I've heard chess commentators talk about that a lot.
This isn't really specifically chess necessarily, but a lot of times you'll hear someone say like your move after like when you're doing something. And usually movies, I guess.
Yeah.
You can totally say it.
There's a sort of general treating the world as a game, very Sherlock Holmesy kind of. I have such a high intellect that the world is a game to me and this crime is a game to me or something like that, and your move. I'm just trying to think of all the chess.
Material.
The
word material? As a concept of like,
nobody ever says
piece of
material, right?
Hmm?
You know, have you in a position where you're kind of in danger, but you can probably get out of it.
Yeah. Oh, what about promotion? Like when you promote to a queen?
Yeah, I think that was a terminology that came from outside chess and got applied into chess. But I've definitely heard checkmate being used outside of chess specifically.
Oh,
yeah, stalemate. Stalemate is, you know, I mean, it's a situation that I generally do associate with chess more than any other game. But you know, a stalemate that happens in a business situation or in a negotiation, right? That's, you know, both of us have no way to be able to gain an advantage upon each other. So that's a good way. That terminology from something that's been as old as chess, has been as old as Go. You know, we haven't preserved much from Tafola, unfortunately, but it can work its way into sort of common parlance. And that's something that he does in the analysis of Go that I don't see in any other analysis inside this one particular book. But you do find it in other people's writing. There's also a lot of talk about who played Go. You know, what's the difference between kind of the Japanese culture of masters, where there are like a few, you know, almost more scholarly than scholars, kind of rarefied elite who are assumed to be the absolute best players of Go, at least in Japan, although that they assume that if you're the best player of Go in Japan, you're kind of the best player of Go in general. But then in Korea, you have a exactly 100-person professional association. Professional as in you're going to make money playing this thing. And there's like a broadcast culture around it. You know, it's kind of like esports before the E. You know, they've been playing board games on TV, right? You know, and it's and there's a lot of hype, there's a lot of and there's money involved in it, and it becomes this rarefied grandmaster class that you're trying to get into, you know, because once you're into that class, then you get to, I guess, make the big bucks as a TV personality. In Chinese, you know, in Chinese culture, it's a little bit more of a very historic thing, right? There's this thing that, yeah, you could play, but you're playing it for historical reasons. It's not considered quite as contemporary a game as Mahjong, for instance, which is very much a social game. You know, this is a game that you play with friends. It's like a game of poker, if you're playing a game of Mahjong. Weiqi doesn't have that kind of cultural resonance, even though it's the same physical, more or less the same physical game as Go. I think there are some minor scoring changes, but you know, otherwise the play of the game is the same. So you know, the evolution of how this game, you know, started off as kind of almost a spiritual activity is something that was promoted by monks as something that helped with meditation, and then moved its way from there into royal courts, and then eventually into the rest of the population for people who aspired to those kinds of, you know, high, lofty social positions. It was seen to be a sort of activity that really smart people will do, and then if you can demonstrate that you're really smart, then you can get jobs for really smart people, that sort of thing, which apparently pay very well in Asia. Then you've got the actual description of how the game is played. But even in this particular write-up, the way how they describe the play of the game, it goes beyond the mechanics very, very quickly. Because the nice thing about Go is that the actual rules of Go are pretty darn simple. The idea of Go is pretty darn simple. If you know, there are black and white stones, each player plays either all black or all white stones. If you play on a grid that's I'm not going to draw the exact number of lines, but you know, it's that sort of thing. But you play on the intersections, and you know, if you've got a situation like this, where you've got one color completely surrounded by the other color on all four sides, you know, this piece is eliminated, it's captured, it's taken off the board, and you can't repeat the same board state immediately. If I have a weird situation where, you know, I've got a black piece here, I've got a black piece here, I've got a black piece here. You know,
yeah,
I think that's right, yeah. And then I immediately place a black piece here, so I capture this piece. The opponent can't then put another white piece here and immediately capture that piece, because that returns the board back to the state that it was just a couple of seconds ago. That's basically the rules. There's a whole chunk of rules on how you figure out who won by basically scoring things, and I've seen students show me many different ways of scoring that, some of them pretty elegant, some of them pretty clumsy, but they all add up to the same number. So it's basically a lot of different algorithms to get the same result. But in the end, the basic idea is just surround your opponent. But once you get from that into all of the higher level strategies of that, okay, out of this game mechanic, what are all of the things that you have to do to be able to play out this game to your own advantage? You start going into things like, how important is it to be able to capture the corners of the board, for instance? You know, what are the typical opening moves that you see in this game? Whereas in his same analysis, in the same chapter of Reversi and Othello, it just largely comes down to, are you playing your pieces like this? Or are you playing your pieces like this? Or do you not have the choice at all because you're playing Othello and that's what you start with? You know, that's basically the entire analysis of the opening moves of Othello that he gives. But then when he goes into Go, it's like there's a whole section on why the opening moves have such a long-term impact. And like chess, there is an opening game, there's a mid game, there's an end game. You know, the end game is kind of like no real surprises at that point. You're just kind of like rounding up what was developed in the mid game. The mid game is where all the really, really sort of strike from behind, call you by surprise stuff happens, and the beginning of the game is just setting up those situations so that kind of thing can happen. So, you know, I think it's nice to be able to try to imagine what a game that has been around that long, that can develop all of that richness, right? There's a cultural richness, there's, you know, game mechanic and strategy richness, there's sort of linguistic richness. Like, how nice it would be to be like the person who designs a game like that, except probably no one will ever remember you, which is kind of sad. But also, what will that kind of game have to have? And I'd like us to indulge in a little bit of like brainstorming. It's like, if you wanted to, like, if it was explicitly your goal to work with the team to try to develop a game that people will be playing 1,000 years from now, what would that game have to have? What would that game need to be?
It really has to be just like chess or Go, in the sense that it has to be simple to learn but have infinite strategy.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be completely and entirely unbreakable, essentially.
Unbreakable? As in?
As in, no computer can ever solve Go. Like, mm-hmm. in the history of humanity, it'll just probably never happen.
Well, no computer solved it yet. I'm not sure if anyone's proven that it can't be solved.
No, it can.
Yeah.
Probably can.
Yeah. And chess has.
The numbers are beyond astronomical.
Yeah.
The chess numbers are astronomical. The Go numbers.
Yeah, the chess numbers are huge. Yeah. Okay.
You can't prove that there's no way to simplify the problem. Like, you're saying, like, you prove that, like, the brute force thing can't be solved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just said the proof that you can't brute force it, but when they said the proof that you can't just, like, for instance, they prove that the Rubik's Cube can be solved in 20. Any Rubik's Cube can be solved in 20 or fewer moves.
Right.
They didn't do this by considering every possible position.
Mm-hmm.
They, they just created some math.
They actually sort of did. They just figured out, certain symmetries about it.
Yeah.
And then solved all those cases.
Yeah.
So a game that's hard to reduce into a simple form, which then can be solved, you know, gives you an idea that, all right, it's always going to be at least a minimum level of complexity. Okay.
I think maybe limited dexterity needs to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
I guess chess and Go, all you do is move pieces around, so just by anybody can do it.
Yeah. I can imagine that, but there are sports that have been around for a real long time, right? And you know, I'm trying to think of one that's been around for 1,000 years, and I'm thinking javelin probably has been around at least that long. Those are dexterous games. But I get the point. If you want to make a board game, that's going to last a length of time. It can't be something like a flicking game. I've played flicking games that have been around, but maybe not 1,000 years. I don't know.
How long has chess been around?
How long has chess been around? Someone with Wikipedia should answer that question. India. At least. Yeah, I mean, it has gone through several different versions. Like, that's the time where the queen was a vizier, you know, and we're talking about versions of the game that existed in India and in the Middle East.
Sixth century,
yeah.
I
think if the most recent version, the most recent change, I think, would be the power of the queen. And that was Queen Isabella?
Kind of, so it's like mid-1400s, early 1500s
yeah.
in Spain.
Right.
Birth of the Chess Queen is a really awesome book to read. But that's about when she gets the...
The zoom right across the board thing.
Yeah.
The most recent world changes have to do with when stalemate is. But
and I'm not so sure. Yeah, there are obviously a lot of iterations over how a tournament needs to be played out, right? The little details. But then things like basic things like how does a piece move? I think the biggest change was probably the queens. And yeah, so what we're talking about is 1400s. Or 1600s within the 200-year period, yeah. When you have a bunch of really powerful European queens, right? You know, and that inspires this.
The game has to be very, very, very balanced.
Very balanced. I think both sides has a good chance of succeeding. Okay. Yeah. I can see
neither
that.
Of those two games are
Go.
Balanced. Chess is very close to being perfectly balanced. But it's not.
Yeah.
It doesn't. I don't think Roosevelt is saying that it has to be exactly balanced.
Yeah.
Just pretty darn close.
I heard it was 55-45, which is not close.
Yeah, 55-45 is not close at all. I wonder.
But what? Is that looking at empirical evidence?
I just heard from a grandmaster that 55-45.
Well, yeah, when two grandmasters sit down to play, the black player tries to stalemate.
Yeah.
So consider the context of grandmaster. Where they're playing 17 games or something, and they're not going to play to win every single game.
Yeah.
I'm sure right now, in Jurassic Play, you get something along the lines of right now, vast majority of games are ending in draws.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But think of the people behind the chess or something. Why would that be? Maybe it's non chess reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. I think Go being black is supposed to be about a 6-point advantage.
Six-point advantage.
So I wonder. So does Does this game have to be competitive in nature?
Does it have to be competitive? Could you make a cooperative game the next time?
We think are competitive. We still don't know the rules for... what's the ancient
Senate?
Game of Ur?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Ur is before Senate.
Yeah, yeah. Senate, all we have is the board.
Yeah, and Senate, I think, was solitaire.
That
one version of it.
No rules exist.
Yep.
Oh, sorry. So Roosevelt and then Matt. Yeah.
No, I was wondering if the game having to be two players would be the requirement. That sort of simplifies things.
Again, let's think not necessarily Go and chess, but also things like athletic sports, right? Are these things that we associate with games rather than just a pure test of strength.
But athletic sports are.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's sort of an abstraction.
Of
but not necessarily ancient ones.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not familiar with ancient
ones. I'm thinking, what's like the oldest team game that we can think of? Hurling?
The one the Lions played, with the balls, you have to get to the hoop.
Oh, yeah.
Is that do people associate that with basketball or I don't know
if there's anything to do with basketball. That's the old sport.
I know in that game you can't use
Yeah. I think rolling on the ground, balls rolling on the ground are a little bit more common. So I'm gonna get you first.
So I was gonna say, sort of based off what Roosevelt was saying about it being balanced, it seems like it's helpful if it's a sort of game where you can sort of build up a culture of like competition around it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like that seems to help keep things relevant.
So it implies that there's some sort of skill that you can develop, and then you can compete against other people. So let me get Laura first.
6.5 points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can look at any evaluation, 6.5 points.
So according to Wikipedia, for chess, it is 52-56% for white. But it said that, and this kind of makes sense, like if you're like novice players, it's pretty much balanced. It's much closer.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense. And it also means that like it does like incentivize people in some way to like try to learn the strategy because like it becomes obviously more advantageous, like the more you know.
The more you know, the better it is for you when you start off as white as opposed to it being just like a completely balanced thing.
For a lot of these, I think that a big cultural incentive can help a lot. So for both of these games, like it was considered, you were basically considered intelligent if you could play it well.
Yeah.
And then for a lot of sports, like you were, if you won the Olympics in ancient Greece or something, like that was a huge deal. So something with cultural significance could really help it develop more because then an entire population would try.
So
become good at it as opposed to a game that doesn't really matter.
So what I'm hearing is like either you end a war by playing a game. That's one way to get some sort of like real cultural significance and a lot of like, sort of athletic events. The Olympics are kind of about that sort of thing, right? Or you get a king to play your game, right? And to really get into your game. Which could work. Definitely chess has had like intellectual leaders, artists for instance. I'm trying to remember which authors were really, really into chess. What was it?
I think it was Recording Games of Napoleon.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if military leadership were into that. I'm actually thinking that maybe instead of balance, what we're going to say is that each side has a fighting chance, right? It's not so off balance that games often end in foregone conclusions. That even when Black has a disadvantage in chess, Black can do something like force a stalemate, and that gives that both players agency over the outcome of the game. Even if what they're trying to accomplish is different, White is trying to accomplish victory, Black is just trying to prevent it.
In chess, actually, the most recent rules change I think was in 2001.
2001, that's a while ago.
Really modifying stalemate.
Yeah, it's pretty stable. I mean, I would say that once you've been around that long, you've had enough like tweaks to your rules that that things can work out. And people are still changing the rules to things like American football, right? And that's Sometimes those rules changes are for things like, well, we need to make it easier for us to insert ads into this game, and American football has had changes just like that. So you know whether that makes it have longevity, I don't know, but it certainly promotes the current health of it. It's like it works with the current sort of economics of times. I don't know if Go and chess ever did that, but at least. But maybe that's where the intellectual, if you can't go for intellectual and cultural value, you can go for commercial value, and then that's, that works too, right? Okay. Any other ideas? If you want to make a game that's going to stand, really, really stand the test of time, either as a folk game, you know, or a sport, or a board game, card game, like, yeah.
I guess not only does it have to be simple to learn, but it should also help if it's simple to teach.
Hmm?
Just like pass on the game really easily to anyone else.
Yeah, you've got to like get generations to pick it up over time. Yeah.
Especially with something like Go, where it's a board and then two different colored rocks.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you don't have like a, you know, manufactured board, you can just like teach someone.
I can rack and draw it on the whiteboard.
Yeah, people have pennies and quarters.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was going to say basically, like, and it also helps a lot if the word is simple.
Mm-hmm,
Because like obviously that means that you don't have to purchase a copy, and that like, it adds extreme amounts of value to like the ability to pass it on.
Yeah. I mean, in sports, you are sort of like you are sort of constrained to a situation of like having a large enough space, flat space that you can play a game. But assuming that's something that's fairly easy to find around the world, you know, maybe increasingly hard as time goes on. Something like soccer is very easy, right? You know, it's like you don't really need a goal; you just need things to mark goalposts and corners, and then you can play. It's probably a little bit harder to do something like baseball, where not only do you need to be able to mark out the playing space, but then you've also got to like have all the right, you know, a stick and a thing that you can throw without hurting anybody, right? Theoretically, you could play baseball with a rock and a stick, but you know, that game's probably not gonna catch on. Or maybe it does. I don't know. Yeah.
Building off of that query, I don't know if this was already mentioned, being able to, I guess, pick up any old objects that
mm-hmm.
resemble the game and
mm-hmm.
still play the game that way.
And it's amazing how that's worked with chess, because chess has so many different pieces, but, you know, you've seen, like, you know, boards being made by people who were basically hermits, you know, handcrafted stuff, and pieces that are just like made out of like, you know, like people who were like survivors of a plane crash, and they were just waiting to be rescued and things like that. You can actually reproduce the board pretty easily. So yeah, and you can just use pieces to be able to reproduce that. I'm wondering if that's necessary. I wonder at what point complex becomes too complex. Because if chess is just on the right side of, you know, just easy enough to reproduce, because I can't imagine it gets much harder, much more complex than chess to get to the point where we just can't reproduce anymore.
Well, yeah, like Mahjong or Shogi.
Oh, Mahjong pieces. Oh, good lord, yeah.
Well, but there's something about them that's going on that chess piece doesn't quite have.
Yeah.
Chess is kind of nice because the pieces don't actually matter. Like, what the piece looks like is really irrelevant for the game.
Right, this is sort of like a...
There's an accepted aesthetic for it,
mm-hmm.
but you can play it with cut out pieces of paper into different shapes.
Right. Or you just draw the icons on it, or you can do the Lord of the Rings chess set, for instance, where instead of a king, you've got, you know, Gandalf or something like that. Yeah.
Another game that's an example of this is Mount Kala,
mm-hmm,
which, according to Wikipedia, is from like the 6th century.
Mm-hmm.
So, and another one that you can just play with like rocks.
Yeah. Mount Kala is a great one. There's, and I think we can talk a lot about mechanics, but I wonder if there's something cultural were symbolic or ritualistic, but also is required.
Mm-hmm.
So like in Kali, you've got agricultural societies, they're sowing seeds. I learned how to play in Bible study school as a kid, because it's, I forget exactly what the message was, but it was, it's an I was a great Christian at the time. But
planting seeds to yield a bountiful harvest or something,
you.
Yeah.
But yeah, but there's it's that agricultural stuff is built into the religion there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, chess kind of has
it's
that
war. Yeah.
And we really saw that in the 70s, but like what is, Go's got, what did it say, Tao, like, popular through Taoism?
Yeah, yeah, it's a sort of a Taoist monks kind of thing, so there's a certain amount of spirituality that's associated with Go, a lot more, there's a lot more sort of spiritual writing that I've seen on Go than say, military strategy writing, whereas chess is very much a military strategy thing, right?
But then the Egyptian game of Senet?
Yep, Senet.
Yeah, and you put the board into the pharaoh's tomb for the pharaoh to play after the... as they're going into the afterlife, it's not played anymore.
How do you know? Maybe they're still playing it.
But it has no current cultural significance.
Right.
It, at one point, it stopped having cultural significance, so it stopped being played.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a game that people have theorized is actually about a journey into the afterlife. So it has cultural resonance for a society that thinks very heavily about what happens after I die, right? And you know, chess makes sense for a society that's either constantly in battle or often in battle. And there was a resurgence in the 60s and the 70s here in the US. And
probably
you know,
had to do with Bobby Fischer, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Also that.
Yeah.
Also that. Celebrities, again. It's nice to have a king play your game. All right. So a couple of things, you know, just to think about. You know, we've been talking in class a lot about productizing games, and you know, especially in the discussion about the Parker Brothers and what it will take to be able to make a game that's going to sell. The last time we had the guests in here to talk about Kickstarter and Patreon and crowdfunding and how to put a game in a box and then ship it to people. But then also, you know, that's the other direction of what if you just try to like make a set of rules that anybody can, you know, with a ball and a field or a, you know, a chunk of wood and that you could carve, you know, a bunch of different colored stones or holes in the ground, you know, could reproduce. And how, what's the design process around designing those kinds of games? You know, it might be, that's a perfectly other legitimate application of game design. And so you might want to think about that. And now that everybody's here, let's hear about your games. Okay. Who needs to use the projector today for the pictures? If not, you don't have to. We can turn it off.
No.
Okay. All right. Then I'm going to shut the projector off. And. Can the ship racing team come up here? And we're going to give you feedback on your pitch. We're also going to give you feedback on and ideas about and tips on the game that you're pitching.
Okay.
So imagine that Rick and I are the decision makers of the publisher that you're trying to get money from.
Oh gosh.
Okay. You're trying to get seed money to be able to finish designing this game that you're currently designing. Maybe you're even employees in our company. Like, we're the heads of Hasbro. You're all designers in Hasbro. And you're going to say, like, this is the game you all want to work on next. All right? And everybody else is kind of like your competition in the company, I guess. But we're not really doing that. They all want funding too. So give us that pitch. And
all right.
You're the leader.
Senior MBA.
All right, let's do it. So, as you know, well, first of all, thanks for having us. Maybe we'll just run through the team real quick. Pro?
Yep.
Jory?
Yep.
Matt and John. And we are Team Ship Racing. And so we're here to tell you why Ship Racing is going to be the number one game for Phil Rick Studios. And as you know, games like Agricola and Suro are some of the top grossing games in recent history. So since we're passionate about Euro-style games and we love path-building games, why not do a mashup of the two kinds of games? So that's for Enter Ship Racing, a mashup of Suro and Agricola. So let me walk you through our vision for this game. There's going to be a common board that looks something like this. We're experimenting with board size, but right now 5x5 has been pretty fun in early prototypes. And this is a common. And then you have a deck of tiles that go into spaces. And each tile, here, I'll blow it up for you, has two nodes on each side. And there'll be multiple permutations of paths, like this one. You guys have played Suro of the Seas?
I haven't, but I...
Okay. So these tiles will go together, and it will help navigate your ship. So if your ship starts here, you play this tile, it ends up here. And so the idea of the game is to start here. It's a race to the finish. So the first person who can go from the left side of the board to the right side of the board is the winner. The cool part is that each player is going to have a player map. And this is going to be a zoomed in view of the ship. And so this is where the worker placement Euro style turn-based game comes into play. So on your ship, it's going to be a simulation. And you're going to get a really good understanding of what it's like to be a ship captain. You're going to be able to steer the ship, man the sails, act as a navigator using the sun, sky, horizon, or tools. You can populate the crow's nest. You can be the cook, you can swab the deck. You could retreat to the captain's quarters to sip whiskey. Or you can even fish off the side of the boat to get food for your crew. And we're not quite sure how, but these are the two elements of gameplay that we want to mash together to really crush it for you guys next year. Is there anything I'm missing?
I'm good with it.
Focus groups loved it in tests.
Early focus groups love it. We have 100 pre-orders already.
It's true.
Yeah, we'd love to hear your feedback.
Okay, just stop for a second. Let's see. So I'm just going to give you feedback, not playing the character that I asked you to treat me as. Okay, I'm just going to give you feedback on the presentation.
Okay.
I think the BA ship captain is actually the selling point of this.
That's
the hook that you're trying to get people excited about. The actual game mechanic and everything of like putting the tiles together, it's intellectually and designerly very interesting, but it's not the thing that it's going to get. And exactly.
There's a hole in the market. There's you can't be a ship captain in any other game, but we're going to give you a chance to.
I think don't even have to do that. I think sell the fantasy of this is the age of sail or something like that. You know, you are a ship captain for the East India Company. you're like some sort of create the fantasy that you're trying to do. Like Ticket to Ride, you are the continent-trotting aristocrat, basically, right? You know? Even though really the game is nothing about that. But that's the fantasy that they're trying to sell when they try to sell you the box.
Right.
And of course, that in a full pitch, you would need to better flesh out what the decisions that you're doing on the boat, how that influences your progress on the map.
Gotcha.
Because it was unclear. It looked like the tile assembling thing, it's already a game all by itself.
Right.
Like Suro. And you didn't make it very clear what drives what. Is that the map building drives the shipboard interactions, or the shipboard interactions give you the ability to move on the map of the 20,000 place you thousand?
I hear you.
Any feedback?
No, I think that's basically it. That's what I was thinking too. I'm curious, what are the primary secondary sources you're using for how Shipcaptain Read works? Why is it that this is, how do you know that you're actually showing experience that it is from the perspective of this person? Like what's the date or what's the range of dates? What's the material you're using, the background material you're using to kind of put that forward?
Good, good. These are questions that we're asking ourselves too, so I'm glad that you are making it explicit, because we really need to dive into the research. We had a lot of game ideas, and now we're just choosing this, and we're going to run with it. So I think that's a good next step. Thanks for helping us with that.
What's the name of the guy who wrote Master and Commander? Patrick O'Brien? I think so. Check that out. I think Brian with an E, B-R-I-E-N. You could do a lot worse than just saying that's our source material. We're making the Patrick O'Brien game, only you're not in the British Navy. You are one of the boats that is carrying cargo at the same time period or something like that. It helps that every one of those books has a map of has a cross section of the ship in one of the pages that just explains all these things. And then the rest of the book is just, they'll just use the terms. They don't even explain where like the crow's nest is or which sail the Byzantine. Whatever it is.
We're going to have to beef up our research. I've never been on a sailboat personally, but the fantasy is something that people can really get along with, right, guys?
Yeah.
Right, competitions? Yeah. MIT has a sailing team, right? So, I mean, come on. It's big here.
All right.
Thank you. Thanks for your feedback.
Can we non-gate
you? You took a lot of my ideas, so now they're not going to seem as original. But.
Well,
you're
wait for
your reference to get a first person. Okay. I'm going to erase this so you forget about this.
We never saw it.
Okay. I want you to close your eyes for a second. Rick, the date is May 28th, 1953. Your name is Sir Edmund Hillary, and you are 300 feet from the top of the world. Philip, same date. Your name is Tenzing Norgay. You have looked at this mountain your entire life and wondered what was at the top. For the first time in the history of your people, you're going to actually reach the summit. The wind's whipping by your face. You've spent the last week climbing this thing. You're finally at the top. You can open your eyes now. This is the experience that we are going to create with Tenzing Norgay. We want to show people what it was like for these two men that had no idea what was going on. They were the second attempt to climb. The first two died in the attempt. And after 12 days of climbing, they set up a base camp at each spot and reached the top. We're going to make a three-dimensional board with 12 different base camps. I'm not going to draw 12 base camps right now because that'll take a little bit. But each level essentially has a base camp. If you ever played the game Descent, there is one kind of dungeon master type player who, it's not like a Dungeon Dragon dungeon master where he creates the entire game, but he controls the monsters, controls traps, how they interact and stuff like that. We're going to have a similar element with the environment. So the environment and the challenges that you face, various equipment failures, and just the unplanned for things that happen during the climb will be laid out by this environment master. It will be him against the two climbers on their way to the top. There will be different boundaries placed on you based on the stuff that they had to fight for. The last two base camps, you have to ascend in 24 hours. If you don't, you'll die of oxygen asphyxiation. By the same logic, when these players pass the second to last base camp, they will have
call it three turns, but you'll have to work on the details, to reach the top. Things like this to make the experience realistic, make them feel like they're actually in the on the climb, on the mountain, trying to reach the top, become the first person in the world to make it. And simple enough, if you make it to the top and get down almost alive, you win. You go down in history, you get knighted. Sounds good?
Yeah, kind of.
That, my friends, is Tenzing Norgay.
Source material that you're looking at right now?
I found a couple websites on just the climb, essentially. I also read a book 2 years ago, not necessarily about this climb, but on the 1996 Everest disaster, which goes into a lot of detail on what it takes to prepare to climb Everest, the challenges that people face, how they feel while they're climbing. And then, obviously, the worst case scenario of what can happen when you get caught on base camp 4 in the middle of a blizzard and 15 people die.
I guess it's a feedback. Obviously, you don't know the feedback that we gave them, and then you launched off it with the fantasy.
I plan on doing that the entire time, and then you said it, and it didn't seem original at all.
No, this is good. This is good. If you have a strategy going in, always volunteer to go first. 3D board. This is less about the pitch, about your style of pitch, and more about the things that you said in the pitch. 3D board. Really think about how you're going to be handling that in on the day itself, right? Come in with a box that can actually fit this. Give us instructions on how we're supposed to assemble this thing. Make sure that it holds up to repeated assembly and disassembly, that sort of thing. Possibly something that may not be essential for your game. You know, something that clearly caught the attention of people in the room when you said 3D part, which is really interesting.
We met yesterday to talk about it, and I said I was thinking about 3D board. I thought it looked cool.
Yeah.
And both Matt and Eddie both said they had the exact same thought.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, then we have to do it.
You might actually want to incorporate the board in your box somehow, so that the box becomes something that can actually be used to support the board. Mm. Because I'm assuming you're making this out of cardboard. But maybe you're using sodium material. It's up to you, really. But do consider things like cost and time if you're going to work with something like that. There is actually a genre of mountain climbing games that looks like two pulleys with ropes. Just string point attached to it, and they're both attached to like one weight. The board itself, the two pulleys at the corner of the board are slightly inclined, and there are holes in there, and the weight can fall in. So the whole idea is get from point A to the top to the other side without falling into a hole, and each player holds on to a different rope. So you know, you get the other. A couple of ideas that are, those were mountain climbing games, so this is very specifically themed on mountain climbing and moving. I'm not so sure whether it has any direct application on your game, but there is a genre.
Okay.
Let's see.
Yeah, I think for me, if it is Tenzing Norgay, I would have wanted to. You kind of hinted a little bit towards his character. Did, like,
I mainly just put that up there because it was the first name that came to mind.
Okay, so so be very clear. Like if that's what you're going to go for, there's actually some really interesting stuff going on there. Use it well. He's Tibetan, you know, Nepali.
Sure.
I don't know. He's a local Sherpa. I have his Wikipedia page.
He's a local Sherpa. He's a Sherpa. He's supporting a European he's supporting a European climber. The European's coming in with money, he's coming in with knowledge of the area and how to survive and things like that. It's just a really rich amount of material to dive into that may or may not be useful for the game you want to make. So just choose which, if you're going to do that, choose why you're doing that. So an alternative would be, what was it, Asmundsen, and for the North Pole, South Pole, really bad at remembering things.
The Northwest Passage.
Basically, the two European guys going to find the North Pole or the South Pole or whatever. They're competitors trying to get there first. Is your game two competitors trying to get there first, or two people?
No, so we thought about the two situations, yeah. And the one we decided we liked was two people working together against one environment person.
Great. Okay. Cool. Yeah, I just wasn't quite sure about that. So that's really great. That's really interesting.
But I like the idea of playing up exactly who these two people were, rather than two mountain climbers with similar skills and abilities, right? It's like, no, there's this offset.
Yeah.
You know, Edmund Hillary can buy things. Maybe not in the middle of the mountain, but you
can. Actually, that's a really good thing. Like, how much of this is...
You could start the game off on at the base camp or something,
yeah.
And have to... you start with a certain amount of money and have to buy the various materials you need or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can go in there. The 24-hour limit for oxygen asphyxiation, really interesting little detail. So just really think about the levels of abstraction you're using and how much you're abstracting away, how much you're using as detail. Some of it's, like, if you're going to do this 24-hour limit, then that might mean that you're focusing on the climb itself and you're not worried about how you got there. You're just setting the player up with what they all the materials they need to do it. Just be consistent throughout the game, what level of abstraction you're looking at.
Okay. Interesting that you brought up being knighted at the end, because that implies not only do you have to get to the top, you have to survive the trip down, and possibly getting up to the top isn't the end of the game. And that, again, comes back to what a sort of Edmund Hillary does, right? One of the things that he does is that make sure that this thing gets published and written up about in the newspapers, that, you know, Tenzing Norgay would not have been able to do it. So at least not even among the European newspapers that's out there. Let's see. Other than that, the environment does not necessarily need to be a GM. It could be another player. You could make it a two player versus one player game.
When you're positioning it as a GM, the way we understood it is that they're disinterested, like a GM's really disinterested.
I compared it to Descent, where you're actually playing against the other person.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, great. Okay. It's more than rules enforcement then you're actually working against. Like, you're not just following.
No, there's a set of rules that everyone has to learn.
Yeah.
I specified not like Dungeons & Dragons Thundermaster,
right.
But where you're actually competitive against the other player.
Cool.
And there's a set of rules that you both have to work within.
You might as well call that Blizzard the Mountain.
Yeah.
Alright, cool. Thank you.
Thanks.
Your first game of which it is untitled.
Do you want to join us? That's fine.
Well, I.
That's
what I was saying. So.
Oh, okay. You can also. I'm cool with you. Yeah. That's cool. I'm Liz.
I'm Laura.
Michael.
And we're pitching Oppressive Game Title. So a very relevant problem in modern day, like right now, is the lack of women in tech industries, and how they're being generally harassed in like gaming culture and things that are like heavy tech-wise in general. And we're trying to address that by exploring that boss-employee dynamic that the women in the tech industry currently have to deal with. And the reason why women are averting the tech industry every day, because it's just easier to do other things. So we're planning to do a live action role play to explore this relationship, where one player plays as the boss and he has the ability to create a new rule every minute or something like that. And one player plays as the employee and she has to follow all the rules that the boss says, and maybe like her ability to produce or be productive is affected by certain phrases that the boss says, which he's required to say, but he isn't sure that, like, he doesn't know that they might affect the person in this way. They're just on the character sheet. It would probably be a minimally replayable game, unless we introduce new characters and new scenarios, maybe modular conditions on like rules, introductions, and the way they respond. And both players will have goals that require the other player to cooperate in order to succeed, so they're going to have to learn to work together in order to accomplish the their goals. So they have to like learn to communicate despite the rules making it hard for them to do so.
In terms of source material, there's currently a wealth of information on the internet about people bringing up this issue in the tech community. It's also something that's particularly relevant on MIT's campus, just because so many people here will go into tech. And so for source material, we're looking at a lot of, you know, there have been a lot of recent articles written on the subject.
Yeah. Also, I have a survey that I sent out for another project that I did that's basically asking for women and the problems they have every day, they encounter every day at work, and a lot of these are in the tech industry. And even if they're not in the tech industry, there's still boss-employee dynamics that we can use to further explore that topic.
So if we have the time, there's sort of an alternative idea that we haven't had as much of a chance to discuss. It's a little less on the side of something that's an educational tool that's minimally replayable and you just play once to like try like end up cooperating, and more of a like maybe toning down the message a little bit for the sake of making it more of a game. The idea is that is similar, where the boss is in charge of the rules as far as the employee goes, so that all of the rules that are in play for a particular session are going to be given to the boss at the beginning or over the course of the game, and the employee would be only told whatever the boss tells them and penalized for whatever the boss decides to penalize them for. There would be some sort of inadequate system for the employee to disagree. And the overall goals might be less cooperative and more directly opposing, where, for example, the employee's goal might be to get the boss fired without getting fired themselves first. And some things that they might do that would like let them do that, finding out things about the rules, might take their focus off of being productive, which would generally lead them to get fired. Whereas the boss's goal could be to end up with a golden parachute, end up being profitable, end up exploiting the employee enough to live happily ever after on their own and like quit themselves at a time where they have enough to just like coast by for the rest. So basically, if they get enough out of the employee before having to either fire them or ending up in trouble themselves, then that would be the other side. That would be the success for the boss.
Nice timing right there. Okay, all right. So, is there anything else you wanted to get in? Or that was pretty much it.
No.
Okay. Let's see. So, a couple of things. It's fine if it's educational. It's absolutely fine if it's educational. In fact, it's nice to have the clarity of like this is. You can specify your audience a little bit more exactly and does design for them. You mentioned minimally replayable, and I'm wondering whether there's some value in playing it twice with inverted roles.
That was considered. Yeah. We meant that it's just if you keep playing as the employee and you already know that you're being lied to, and if even worse, if the rules stay the same and you already know the rules, then that's completely defeating the purpose.
You can still play it to explore the relationship further. And maybe like see what else you could have done, but fundamentally you know like the punchline.
You know the game.
Oh, just one thing with live action though is because it's live action, because you're two people working together talking about this stuff. Even if the rules are the same every time you play
it's
it,
gonna be,
that other person's going to be different.
Yeah.
It's not. I don't worry about minimal replayability. It's very replayable.
Okay.
Yeah. And definitely reusable among in a training setting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It will be usable. if you don't play it again, at least, and I will say, no matter what you do, you should do a debriefing part of your rules.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you talk with each other after the game is over? For educational games, especially live action educational games, you absolutely need that, because that sort of helps people reflect and, you know, on what they should have picked up while they're playing game, but while they're playing game, they may not be able to think about how is this reflected in my real life.
Yeah.
Right.
Great thing for that, if you can do that without requiring a facilitator, you're already doing much better than a lot of the games in the sector. It gets your game a little bit more useful, a little bit more used, if your players can debrief each other.
You describe specifically the relationship between a boss and an employee, and it seems like that's, I guess you should be clear whether all of the tension is specifically between these two people, or whether there's also any abstraction of like the culture around the two people. Because, you know, say in a stereotypical male boss, female employee situation, there's a lot of culture supporting the male boss. That's not there for the people.
Right.
So how do you work that in the sort of touchy phrases thing reminds me a bit of Taboo, which may not necessarily be the vibe you're going So think about that. For research, microaggressions, I think, is one thing that comes up a lot. Is it like a good search term to actually just put into a general thing? And you get a lot of stuff, not just gender, but also like ethnic discrimination, disability, stuff. So you can find a lot of material in like academic writing about this sort of relationship and get ideas from how the mechanic is. I'm not so sure about it being competitive, actually, because.
So just to make clear, those were like kind of very two very separate.
Paths, and actually, for a feature for a pitch, don't pitch two ideas. Yeah. I had a hard time following the second one. If you're going to pitch the second idea, a very simple two line, and if we did this other way, this is how it would be. It would be enough to get it across.
I mean, it obviously came up here because we're not at the stage where we have one idea.
Well, no, but I mean, so we heard a very clear idea that was still not specific, but pretty general. And then if with this extra idea, this alternate route, it's really just a matter of noting a two-line version of how does this differ from the other without having to go into detail on it.
Describing it, I guess, as a variant rather than, you know, it's like this is a variant that you're playing, that you're discussing with right now, rather than here's a second idea. This is just a general pitch.
Yeah, saying that we haven't talked about it. If you haven't talked about it enough, don't talk about it. We don't need to hear it.
If you were trying to get money, you know. But since you did bring it up, I'm just going to get my perspective from a design point of view. I think that actual competitive game might... different goals is fine. But the sort of like... opposed goals, you know, get this person fired, that sort of thing, I think takes the game out of a situation that a lot of people can see themselves in, because a lot of people don't actively want to get other people fired, or at least don't see themselves that way. So just to be able to make a game where people can easily make connections back to their real life, the goals should be a little bit closer to a non-competitive even though it may not be a completely aligned goal. Any questions for us? Or if anyone else has questions?
And then just another quick thing for research. We did an equal pay game jam 2 years ago, I think. And there were some interesting things that came up with like talking about specific scenarios. So how there's the fact women don't necessarily have the, well, at the time it was thought that, you know, didn't have the data to get a pay raise. So maybe it was just a matter of, well, they don't have the data, so if we just give them the data, maybe we'd help them. No, it's not. It's much more complex than that. But think about what are the, like, I'd be really interested to see, like, what kind of scenarios you're gonna do. Are they gonna be very specific, like going to your employee to try to get something that you need? Or is it gonna be, what I think I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, an employee coming to a boss to try to just do the job they need to do, and the boss kind of making it difficult for them to do it.
Yeah, I think the
latter.
Latter situation is more.
Cool.
I was thinking at the very least.
There's a lot of stuff about how the same adjective we need to use to describe a female professional and or a male professional
mm-hmm.
is can be positive in one sense and negative in the other, and just the same word, literally. And maybe that was what you were going with the basis thing, but definitely a lot of writing about that.
Yeah.
And really good to see you already did a survey. Getting actual phrases that you can use and actual perspectives
mm-hmm.
is awesome.
So I guess I have a question, which is, how would you recommend dealing with the fact that the players might not be the gender that they're playing?
So that could be a very valuable learning experience.
Yeah.
No, I understand. I mean, the fact that even what you just said about the phrases,
right.
if you're having a conversation and that like word comes up,
mm-hmm.
and even it just won't mean anything necessarily to someone.
You,
in
if
the
you're
rules,
worried about that,
yeah.
you can use game mechanics for that.
Yeah.
If it's known that that word is going to have a positive or negative effect to that particular gender, then you make a mechanic around that.
Okay.
If you're trying, your mechanics should support these things. There's times when you don't need a mechanic because just players will understand. But any game when you're talking about these kind of cultural things, the mechanics kind of just help buttress the message, the things you're trying to get across.
Yeah, all the research implies that this system already exists. So your game mechanics are just making the system obvious. You know,
And then that stuff should just come out in debrief. When you have, especially if you have two people with different genders and different experiences talking about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Indiana Jones.
No, crossing. Yeah, right. There was no gray.
I think it's a J.
We have a third group member, Damon, who is not here today.
Okay.
Okay. Our game mostly explores the dynamics of sort of the balance of power that can occur when there's there's three people who are sort of all fearful of the others there, and how there's very much an unstable equilibrium there, where there's very much this unstable equilibrium. Like they were trying to keep up with the other two and make sure that no one gets far ahead of them, but the game dynamics will be such that this is guaranteed to fail in the long run. As such, one of the main things that players will have to do is try to realize when they have a large enough advantage to strike, and it's really about finding the moment of opportunity when they can make an attack that will work out well. They've also explored some of it's intended to be sort of a strategy game, but sort of lighter than some of the versions that cover similar topics that can take several hours. It's going to cover a lot of the historical trends around the time, such as like the conflict between sort of populist reformers and the conservatives, and like sort of the rise of the equestrian class and their importance as a power base to some of the leaders there, and also how the legions, the loyalty of legions was shifting from like the Senate to individuals who are actually paying them and giving them the lands that they would retire to. That's what this game covers.
Source material is, I
took a class in Roman history, and it's mostly just stuff that I remember from that. I've looked at various sources of lines for detailed stuff on like exactly, on like the details of numbers of legions and where they were stationed, and that's about it.
So, yeah, feedback. So we remember the games about the tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
The game, I don't remember who, what personal perspective it's from. So the pitch should have had that in there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just totally, yeah.
So just in the future. But so if you want to reiterate that, could you?
Yeah, I just completely forgot to describe exactly what the game was. But yeah, it's the Valiars are the three members of the first triumvirate, and they're all sort of Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus, and they're sort of jockeying for influence in an eventual plan to sort of usurp the other team and become the sole leader of Rome.
I definitely, for a pitch, you have to assume that your audience doesn't know that.
Yeah.
The audience may have heard of Caesar and not realize that at the time that your game is occurring,
mm-hmm.
he's not in charge.
Yeah.
You know, that's because everyone assumes Caesar means king, right? And
mm-hmm.
That's not the case. Who is Pompey and who is Crassus, especially Crassus? Like a lot of people haven't heard.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a bit about light strategy,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering if that means this is still a war game, or is it a little bit more of a political points type game? You know, do you expect that it's going to be like a victory point based system, or is it going to be more about military, you know, squashing other legions kind of thing?
It's going to be sort of it's not going to have a victory point system. It's going to be sort of the way you win is by sort of crushing the other two players. There are multiple like paths that this can happen. You can like get enough legions to become personally loyal to you that you can just beat the other two people and the Senate kind, or you can gain enough support from various groups in Rome that you really just start like. That you really can just start to snowball, and you have a force, and you just have a tremendously large force that the other players can't deal with. It's going to be a war game, but with sort of more. It's action selection, and that the players will have a choice of actions that they can take. The game will probably be such that you just the players will go in order, and over about a 10-year period or maybe a 15-year period, they'll have about four actions per year there. So it's the sense for that. For instance, if the players build new buildings or conquer new provinces, it makes more actions available there. Also, the struggle if you depending on whether the Optimates, the Conservatives, or the Populares, the Populists are sort of in power, or have more power, different actions are available also.
So I just had like maybe three different images,
mm-hmm.
just from that last description,
yep.
of
yeah.
what this game could be. On one hand, you described it as, you know, Roman war game,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking units and pieces on a hex grid.
It's very much you go and you will you sort of it's very much you take sort of it's very much this where the players are just choosing, like, if you want to go invade Gaul, you just say, okay, I'm gonna go launch an invasion of Gaul here, I'm gonna take this. You'd have to prepare for it. You'd have to make sure that you have like the specific, that you have like the position that you could go do this, that you have the resources to raise the legions necessary there. You also might want to acquire land to acquire your veterans if you're successful. And then once you launch the Ancient Invasion, there'd be a factor of luck to determine how successful you are there. And you would probably continue repeating the same few actions to continue your invasion for several years there.
Okay, so and that gives me a completely different image of what your name is, which is more of like a, I'm collecting resources, maybe the representative of cards, maybe the representative of tokens,
That's like the second image that I that we are conjuring in my head with the way how you're describing this. And then you said action selection, and then I'm thinking that is really just like almost like a card game, right? It's almost like a game where these are the things that I could be doing right now. Maybe there aren't any physical cards that are telling me, but then you already described if you get, say, influence over the population, you get new kinds of actions that you can then put.
The actions aren't really personal but sort of are sort of global there.
Right.
So as in the sense that if the populists are in power there, there is a set of actions that you can take is sort of different because the political possibilities are different political possibilities. So like if the populists are in power, it's much easier to get land for your veterans, for instance.
Oh, I see. So you still have the same actions, but then it's how hard it is to all the likelihood of success.
Some of them might get like grayed out or something as if they're
specifically
what happens is as the influence shifts, I imagine that the actions will sort of that they'll flip over there. Like instead of the populace being able to do this, instead the conservatives able to do this. If you have
so I think I'm getting a much clearer idea of mm-hmm. what your game is gonna look like, but that's something you want to get across in the pitch.
Yeah.
You know, it's like what you can use the board, you can use hand gestures like you just did.
Referencing other games.
Referencing other games. Just so that, you know, when you're talking about the game,
mm-hmm.
you're trying to help me see it in my head. Because
yeah.
Especially because I don't have
yeah.
It so early in the project. Let's see.
Just one other last thing. So we're going to have three players. We're going to each be one member of the triumvirate.
Yes.
I imagine each of those historical people had different perspectives of how they saw things. Were they equal?
The game is going to be portraying them as having equal views and sort equal like the same goals, the same views, the same perspectives, and everything. But it treats them different, that they will have different starting resources and different advantages and disadvantages
okay.
as the game goes through.
So
Crassus will have like more money and Bosus acquiring money, for instance. I've imagined that Pompey will sort of start with more with a lot more influence than the others.
Is there a historical or a realistic basis for any of that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like Crassus is often called the richest man in history. There, he is known for just acquiring such as just massive. Like he had more money than basically the Roman government.
So that's going to at least help him with the players, the player starting position. Did that wealth? So I guess what I'm asking is that wealth then carried over into the kinds of actions that he was able to do historically, or was it really just setting up?
It's going to offer him. I mean, I haven't decided whether or not it will offer him bonuses towards acquiring wealth, or whether or not he will just have more
okay.
wealth at the start of the game. There,
from our point of view, for the assignment, we're really interested in seeing the personal perspectives.
Yeah.
So you could do the generic, you know, they're each an equal person. It'd be more interesting from us to see it really reflect.
Yeah.
Their actual personage.
The differences I think are really going to shape their strategy and how they sort of play there. So Caesar will either have a bonus towards campaigning, or not necessarily a bonus towards military invasions, but making his legions loyal to him.
Cool.
His legions become loyal to him quicker. I'm not sure and Pompey sort of will start out with sort of more powerful and prestigious than the others, but during the first several years of the alliance there, he was was obsessed with his wife Julia, who was Caesar's daughter that he had married there, and he was really, and he was like neglecting lots of his responsibilities because of his life there. So he will probably have sort of penalties, and like he would like miss every fourth action or something. He starts off in a much more powerful position, and he sort of has to use limited actions to try to not fall behind in the earlier part of the game there. So even though these players sort of have the same goals, but they're going to be taking different but these small differences are going to cause them to take very different strategies oftentimes.
So I'm actually going to suggest that the differences are what your game should be built on. not the sort of bedrock of similarities that, you know, it seems to me that you're describing that there is this objective reality which all three of them agree on,
mm-hmm.
and are just playing on this field with their individual advantages.
Yeah.
But I think I'm going to suggest that for that you start from the differences.
Mm-hmm.
Start from the fact that one of them is richer than everybody else, one of them's more loved than everybody else, and one of them's just flat out a better military commander.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, and then you can just what if the game was all about those differences rather than everything else that was involved that was happening at the time? Because then you get a little bit closer about how these three particular people see the world rather than what historians necessarily have seen.
I guess one thing is I really like a lot of the differences to sort of be sort of emergence,
mm-hmm.
and sort of to have the these differences that they act like the way intend to have sort of these bonuses that are really not going to be like they're just going to be like one line, like something fairly simple, but will cause the players to be playing almost completely different games. Where Crassus is basically trying to like take actions that are just acquiring is going to try to where Crassus is basically going to try to like acquire lots of money and then use it to sort of brute force his way through money, try to brute force his way to get the most efficient ways to use this, or try to.
Okay, so set
and
that up to be your design goal.
Yeah.
Then it's like it's not just does this simulation play out. Set out the design your design goal for your project should very much be. It really should be like all three players end up playing very different games, even with
yeah.
the same set of goals.
Yeah, that's definitely what the design goals there. That like Caesar's going to be sort of. He sort of has the potential, but he needs to be able to get the resources so that he can really ramp up there. Whereas Pompey sort of has this power and is basically going to be sort of trying to consolidate it and try to and sort of threaten the other two's growth and sort of threatening the growth of the other two.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Okay, so now's probably as good a time as I need to take a short break. We'll have about these games generally don't take more than 45
minutes.
45
minute games for the most part. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are related to the reading that of space control. Not so many chase games, more space control games. And although Ticket and Ride, I guess, has some sort of like set building in there as well. Play through the game. I mean, it seems like a lot of people didn't do the reading, so I'm not so sure how much context it give you. But I do still want you to end up having played a wide range of games before the end of the semester. And then about 3:30, I guess. A little before 3:30, we'll bring in the prototyping boxes, and then you can spend the rest of the class working in the teams. Cool.
Go over the games really quick.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. So Panic Station has a little bit of a. It's got a lot of a trader mechanic. You are trying to survive at a space station, but there's aliens and they're infecting you, and you're going to infect the others too. Carcassonne's another one of those path building games that has area control and other things on that. French medieval towns, barely themed. Through the Desert.
It's kind of like mapping path.
Yeah, path building, mapping. You're creating a supply chain line of camels through the desert. It's a Rainer Knizia game. I've not played Quirkle. It's match score and win.
It's like Domino's kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And every one of these games that we brought up so far, all actually, I'm not, these three games are all about like putting tiles down. This one is more about putting. I was going to say putting dudes down, but really you're putting down camels. So they're really cute camels.
Yeah, this is putting down trains, but you're putting them down through creating sets. So creating matching sets of train cars.
Yeah. Cool. All right, so break and then game.